Okay, so what I propose to do is ask each of the panel members one question and then open it up to the floor. So start thinking about questions for the panel, and what I would ask, if you could raise your hand if you have a question, and state your name and the organisation that you're represented today. So look, I'll get things underway with a question each for the panelists. And Chris, I think I'll start with you, if that's okay. So one of the issues that Fragerman is observing is the dynamic and fast changing nature in the way businesses are recruiting. So my question is, can you comment on the changing nature of work, skills mobility, and how companies are recruiting talent and managing their global workforces? In addition, can you also comment on how Australia's temporary visa programs are coping with this change?
Sure. Well, as you said earlier, and I think it was touched on with, data scientists weren't on the list. Well, I'll see your data scientists raise you a scrum master, because I've heard that one and had no idea. I thought it was a rugby position or something. I'm from Melbourne, I didn't really get it. But we're seeing it all the time, and from a recruitment perspective, the roles that are being released to us, we're having to Google what it is before we even find out, you know, how we're going to source the candidates. So just the dynamic nature of how quickly the roles are changing is really difficult. But also what's happening with that is that it's becoming more about seeking skills. Experience is good, but skills are becoming more critical. There's talk that the modern CV in a few years will list skills down the centre of the page, and as a side tab will say where you've worked. Because it really will be the skills that people are recruiting. And then if you look at that, all of a sudden that brief of we're looking for a candidate who's got 5 to 10 years of local market experience might be I'm looking for a candidate who's got 5 to 10 years of data science experience, and therefore the border around Australia is irrelevant as we're looking to the people who can bring that skill to Australia. So that globalisation is coming whether we want it or not. The roles are going that way. We're a country with great ambition to bring technology, automation, robotics to our industries such as mining. But to do that, we have to look abroad as well to bring the skills in, and employers are increasingly aware of that. So how the current visa scheme is coping with that, I'd echo something you said earlier about the lack of a direct pathway to PR and some classifications is a real detriment. And something we feel pretty strongly about is if you want people to come and fulfil the job well but bring their best self, it typically would involve bringing their loved ones, their family, and telling the story of moving to Australia, which is how a lot of us got here in the first place. And when you're saying you can come for a bit but you've got to get out again after 2 years, I think that makes it a little more challenging story to sell. So hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. That's great. I'll just add, just in terms of the public sector, I guess, keeping up with how companies are recruiting. So with the introduction of labour market testing requirements by the department in 2018, it was interesting to note that the acceptable platforms for advertising, when they were initially released, didn't include LinkedIn as a platform that was acceptable. However, what was acceptable was national radio. So I'm not sure how many people last got their job through listening to national radio, but it's just an example where, you know, that feedback to the department on how things are changing is critically important. I should add that LinkedIn is now an acceptable platform, but there were a bit of lobbying efforts in that regard to fix that one. So, Paul, if I can move to you, look, while the unemployment rate in Western Australia still remains one of the highest, there are signs that the state's improving economy and increasing job opportunities, particularly in the resources sector. Some commentators have suggested that there's a bidding war already underway in terms of in searching for workers to fuel the next cycle of mining activity in the state. So in the last mining boom, Western Australia poached workers from all over the country. And questions remain whether there is the same opportunities this time around. So from your perspective, I'd like to ask, where do you see the current and future skill shortages, and how prepared is Western Australia for what's been dubbed a mini boom for the resources sector?
Yeah, good question, and something that's been on our lips for many years. If we could only get our resource brothers, our blue chip miners, Rio Tinto and BHP, to step out their projects and do them one after the other instead of not doing anything for 3 years and then doing four major billion-dollar projects in the Pilbara right now, all together at the same time. So we have seen a massive a gradual increase in demand up until around about 2 months ago, where we're starting to lose people from our company, which is a medium-sized engineering consultancy and project management in the resource sector. We've started to lose quite a few, and actually this week already, and it's only Wednesday, we've lost three to those big projects. So I don't see many opportunities, because we did get a lot from the eastern states in the first boom, and that was a mega boom, and this boom won't be as big as that, but it is still reasonably large, and we'll put a strain, I think, on not only my companies like the company I work for, but and this is going to be a problem that I think John Lagalon, chairman of the Infrastructure WA, will start to see as engineers from my type of company move into the blue chip miners. So then will public projects and sort of smaller investment type projects start to lose people to the mining industry, and that's when we'll really start to see some of those problems. We'll see project costs blow out as we are forced to promote within the industry people who are probably not quite so prepared for those roles, and then they really struggle, and you see some quality issues develop, and then you see some poor supervision and a fair bit of rework required based on the technical side, but also in the field. And sometimes you can make a construction error, and it can cost you a lot of money. So we certainly are seeing that. My role with Engineers Australia, we have been aware that this was going to come down and hit us, because mining has been cyclical for many years. The last one was extremely large, the last boom. And then the cliff, as I call it, not just a downturn, but an actual cliff, was quite traumatic for the town and many people in the city. So with Engineers Australia, we've been trying to promote within our high schools and with our universities for people to uptake some of these roles. But we haven't seen good enrolments over the last couple of years. We're seeing an uptick now, and that's always the way it goes. When things are going down, we see enrolments fall. When things are going well, we see the enrolments increase. And those new enrolments now would probably just graduate just as the downturn is hitting again. So it's a real issue for us. So we don't see any opportunities from eastern states in the major boom. We saw fly in, fly out of New Zealand, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia. With the uncertainty around temporary immigration, it was touched on earlier. You're not going to get a professional person to up his family and move to Australia for a couple of years of uncertainty. So, the opportunities, it's a real challenge for us, and we've known about it for quite some time, and we've been advocating with government, with my colleague Susan up there from Engineers Australia, to try and get more people studying STEM, but it's a long way from what we really need. So to answer your question, I don't see a great deal of opportunities. I see some great opportunities for people graduating right now, but in 4 years' time, the downturn will probably be over again, and they'll be struggling again.
So Gabby, one for you. So one of the key recommendations in the report is that ANSCO, so it's the Australian New Zealand Standard Classification for Occupations, which hasn't been updated since 2013, needs to be reviewed as soon as is practicable. How does this reflect on the performance of the temporary skilled visa program? And in light of the predicted mini boom for the WA resources sector, and the CEDA research. Can you also comment on the likely economic and social impact of a greater proportion of migrant workers in WA?
On ANSCO, I think it's pretty well established that it's a dated list. And it not only, I am going to take off my temporary migration hat for a second, and also say that it also contributes to like permanent skilled migration too. So if you want to, I gave the example earlier of a data scientist, if you wanted to migrate independently to Australia as a data scientist, you'd have to make sure that your course has all of the requirements as per ANSCO's requirements of like a data analyst programmer, which for those in the know is completely different to what a data scientist does. A data scientist does database stuff. They do modeling, they do stats, they do a whole bunch of different things that doesn't quite fit into the categories that we have. It's kind of like fitting a square peg into a round hole a little bit, and we're trying to force this. So it's very much not fit for purpose, and even with some of the examples that you gave earlier around how it's impacting mining, so it's not just in the tech fields, it's in the mining fields as well, and the services fields as well. And then in terms of the mini boom, one of the things I think I'm most concerned about, especially in light of the new 482 visa changes, is that pathway, and I think that's coming out quite strongly through our discussion. The fact that there is no permanent pathway, and that, you know, once people finish their contract, have to go back to wherever they were, I think that's really detrimental to the economy. It means that people don't get a chance to put down roots, and I think that's really important in terms of making sure that the community has some kind of longevity and that people are able to feel strongly, able to send their kids to school and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, they can't do on a 2 to 4 year visa that they have no certainty about.
Thank you. Yeah, just a couple of comments from me as well. I mean, so ANSCO classifications are a part of our sort of day-to-day role. And I call it more of an art than a science. You know, we're having to be very creative to make the to make a fit with positions, and it's getting to the point where it's becoming a very complex exercise and providing some very sort of key limitations. So it is something we've been advocating for a long time. It's not a responsibility of the Department of Home Affairs. It's actually a responsibility of the Department of, or the Bureau of Statistics. So hopefully the recommendation in the CEDA report will have some leverage there. So thank you, Gabby. So with that, I'd like to open up to questions from the floor. So I think we've got a question already. So thank you.
Yes, Phil Thick from Tianqi Lithium. Thanks for your comments, and Gabriella, particularly interested in yours. As a company building the world's largest lithium plant, we don't have a single person in Australia with the skill of running a lithium plant. Yet it's taken us more than 12 months to get a half a dozen people here on a 400 visa, and even longer on 482 visas from China to help us and actually train our people so that they're transferring technology into the West Australian market. That's just a disaster for us, and I've now got a dozen people flying up to China next week because that's a whole lot easier than doing it the other way around. So really good that you're raising all these issues. I don't know what the answers are though, but we're missing out on some significant opportunities in that space by making this really difficult. And I think your chart, Gabriella, up there, which I couldn't read any of because it was so complex, I understood that fully, and that's the world we live in, unfortunately. And 457s disappearing and being replaced by these others hasn't made it easier. It's made it a damn sight harder.
That's not a question. That was a policy statement. Sorry.
Just to follow on from Phil, there's a real risk that we actually start to lose work overseas, and Phil just touched on it then. Engineering is something that can easily be done overseas, and if we can't get the people here, they'll send it overseas.
Yeah, look, it isn't easy. It isn't an easy process. It can be time-consuming. There is a lot of red tape. Our clients face frustrations. The department does try does listen, and there are certain programs. One of them that was introduced recently is accreditation. And it's a fast track for TSS applications for sponsors with a track record. So look, that would be one thing that I would sort of comment on, that there is some options out there in terms of companies that need to rely on these programs to get the best possible outcomes.
And I just wanted to say as well, like even though we do recommend that ANSCO be reviewed, I can't help but have this sinking feeling that we're going to have this problem again and again. We're just never really going to be able to catch up. So there are some views out there that maybe we should do away with the ANSCO recommendation, lift the threshold to above a certain amount, you know, keep the Skilling Australia Fund levy and just let businesses put their money where their mouth is. If they want to employ people who are that skilled and they're willing to pay them that much, let them do it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the presentation very much. My name's Robin Walsh. I'm the owner. I've been in operation for 30 years. I'm the owner of After Navitas, the largest pathway provider for international students in Western Australia. So over the 30 years, we've seen our market share plummet from 14% to now we're under 5% of the national share. So out of the 500,000 students in Australia, there's only 35,000 left in Perth. And that number is fast depleting. So this, the brightest and the best, high-performing students are all heading to Hobart, Adelaide, Canberra, by the hundreds. And the reason is because they are now aware of this new population policy that's coming in November, and they are aware that the only way they could possibly be considered for permanent residency, although 16% of them will only take it up, there's a perception that they're not welcome in Western Australia. So they're very eager to get to Hobart and Adelaide, where they can enrol in a world-class university, they can go to ANU, and they can receive all the incentives that's offered through this policy, $5,000 extra scholarships, 2 years extra stay on their visa for work-study rights, fast-track visa processing. And it's all because we are classified like Sydney and Melbourne. We are a big city. We're bigger. We're as big as Melbourne and Sydney in the eye of the federal government. This is catastrophic. And I want to know how we can leverage a narrative that shows that Perth is not having the infrastructure problems that Sydney and Melbourne have, and that we're having a massive brain drain of these students who have paid for all their ELICOS training, for 1 year of English study, all their undergraduate study, and they get to master's, they're just straight out the door. So this is a really major industry that has huge potential. It's a very soft industry. It's a very environmentally friendly industry, but it's being destroyed by this population policy.
So, look, I might... Gabby, did you want to make a few comments?
I think the regional Australia policy was a bit ham-fisted, I would say. I don't think that the effects have been properly thought through in terms of what that's going to do to cities and cities like Perth and states like WA. And I think it does create a whole range of perverse incentives like the ones that you've mentioned. And there's also no information about how those communities are going to be dealing with the influx of new migrants. It's not a good stage. But also the other thing that's also happened simultaneously is the introduction of the post-study work visas. That link to its permanency has softened quite a lot. And now we're seeing a whole bunch of former international students, you know, get their post-study work rights, work for 2 years, and then, you know, panic about what they're going to do after. They have to get a business to sponsor them. So I think it's a really unfortunate turn where we're closing the doors to students who've, you know, made Australia home for at least about 6 years by the time they get to the end of the post-study work visa, and just saying, no, actually, you're not welcome. I think that's really tragic.
And look, I'll just make a comment. Look, I think it's really important, the messages the government send, and I think some of the messages that have been sent by government relating to international education in Western Australia have really had an impact. And I think it's been a number of years of a downward spiral. And look, it requires a lot of concerted effort now to get get Perth, Western Australia, you know, back on track in the right direction with international education. I think with a lot of policy making that comes out of Canberra, a lot of it can overlook Western Australia and the unique things about this state. Look, some of the policies I've seen, you know, works well for Newcastle, Wollongong, but seems to come undone when it hits the west.
Is it time to secede again?
So next question.
Michael Henderson, the past chairman of the Technology Industry Advisory Council. I'm just interested that we always seem to be so surprised that we're having these boom busts and that we're finding students coming in that are graduating as we're starting to see the economy drop. How do we change this? You know, there's pieces of work that have been done by TIAC, CCI, State Training Board and others, but we're not cohesive in bringing these pieces of work together. We seem to see organisations act in silos. So that's my first question. How do we change this? The second one is, big data is not new. New South Wales has got a chief data scientist. We don't have a chief data scientist. Yet we look at the work that's being done with Woodside and some of the other resource companies. I would have thought as a state, if we're really serious about how we're going to try and manage this roller coaster ride, that we've got key positions filled.
Yeah, good question. So, Paul, did you want to make us start with that question?
Well, what we do about the enrolments, I guess you're talking on there, is we've had a big push and been working with a lot of organisations around, as I said earlier, getting kids to study the STEM units. There's been some mediocre of success, but I wouldn't call it achieving its goal just yet. I don't have an answer for that. We do what we can in my organisation and many other organisations. And what I've learnt in this past year in the role of President of Engineers Australia WA is there are a lot of people doing a lot of things. So it's certainly an issue that we are aware of. Maybe it's not well coordinated. There's things happening that I just find out about now that have been happening for quite some time. Do we think government should get more involved? I'm not a big advocate of getting government to do everything and solve all our problems. Industry should get more involved. I don't see a lot of effort from some of our big companies, our big blue chip miners, who have really contributed to this this problem in WA. So I don't really have a solution other than there are organisations in Perth doing what they can.
Yeah, I would just add to that the rise of the gig economy or whatever you want to call it is part of that solution to be able to have a highly skilled workforce that's mobile and portable and can move around projects. But that is obviously a contrast to trying to get stable population and build regional towns and all these things, which is a massive challenge. To your point on the pathways and the kids and coming through in STEM in particular, you'll notice that from the major mining houses, there was a pathway there at one stage saying, come work for us, we're doing automation and robotics, and we're a tech company now. We're not just digging holes and things, and it fell on deaf ears because every company's embracing automation and robotics. So that's not a point of difference. Now you'll see we're energising the world. It's all about the social license to operate, but also appealing to kids coming through who have a much more environmental mindset. And I think that was probably a few years late, some of that pivot on marketing to the younger generation coming through, but it should start to take effect hopefully with the kids coming through sort of high school now, hopefully.
And Gabby, any sort of comments from an economic lens on that one?
Nothing further to add, okay. Sorry.
Great. So, next question.
Geraldine Mellett from Mercy Care. I wonder if I can get your thoughts on a group of skilled job seekers who are largely overlooked in this conversation. There've been a couple of great studies by Deloitte Access Economics looking at the skills of migrants, refugees and asylum seekers who don't seem to be part of the equation, and they looked at the cost of the underutilisation of their skills and said that many of the skills that they have are actually those that ones that are forecast to be in skill shortage in the next 10 years. We have around 1,500 job seekers from these backgrounds at our Jobs and Skills Centre in Mirrabooka, but they face all kinds of barriers in getting jobs, largely a lot of unconscious bias, a lot of other things. They're on a variety of visas. All of them have full work rights, and all of them end up being here for years, even if they don't get PR, but they're all trying to get on the path to PR. I'd love to get your thoughts on what can be done to start working with these people to take away some of the barriers. And if you look at the studies on diversity, you're looking at the benefits of getting these kinds of job seekers who are incredibly resilient, bring all kinds of extra languages, extra skills, overseas experience, and a huge desire to stay in one place and work for one company.
Do you like to make some comments on that issue?
Yeah, look, I can comment on it, and absolutely, we see it all the time. It is, you know, subconscious, unconscious bias. It plays a huge part in it, and in some elements of, I guess, the employers, they're trying to tackle that to mixed effects. There's right down to what they're calling naked CVs, where really there's no indication on a CV whatsoever as to the ethnicity or anything or gender or any of that on the CV. It has failed in parts, that approach. So I'm not sure anyone has the answer yet. I think I can't really comment as to the visa limitations, but I think from an employer's perspective, the diversity journey that many major employers are on is only going to help. I think it's now a really common knowledge that the impact of a diverse workforce, not just at entry level, but through to the board, is having. So it should be on the improve, but I know that's not necessarily going to help that person out there who's desperately looking for a job.
I could comment. I think if we could fix the conversation around those particular individuals and not make it such a divisive issue in the community, they'd probably be a lot more welcome, because there's not going to be many employers who want to employ those people who fit the category you decide when we don't even know as a community what we're doing. We don't know whether they're coming in or leaving or staying. So they need some certainty in what their future is before employers are going to employ them. That would help to solve that conversation.
And just, you know, having worked with refugees over the years and seen a number that with engineering qualifications, for example, from Iran, just with the transferability of qualifications, is that one of the barriers?
There are some barriers, but they're not insurmountable. Great that you mentioned Iranian engineers. Probably one of the best engineers we have in our organisation come from there. They are absolutely incredibly trained, really well trained. Having said that, a couple of weeks ago, I was in a cab with an Iranian engineer, and he couldn't find work just yet. And I think a lot of the uncertainty around this immigration. Yeah, I think a lot of the conversation around those individuals just don't recognise that opportunity.
Great question.
So Tim Shanahan from WA Super. I'd like to make a comment and then ask you maybe, Justin, for your views on this, because it seems to me that this issue is, you know, a rise of nationalism around the world, you know, constraining migration. You see the sort of deplorables in the US that sort of celebrate this sort of stuff. You're heading for a no-deal Brexit, which is going to considerably constrain, you know, the passage of people throughout Europe. So, you know, what's happening in Australia isn't unique, I would think. And I think CEDA's to be absolutely commended for ventilating this issue and bringing some rigour to it. But I suspect the argument's been lost against the backdrop of what are the actual benefits that, you know, skilled migration brings to Australia, and Western Australia in particular is an outlier in terms of, you know, overseas migration essentially being the growth driver for our population. So I suppose that's a comment. My question would be, given Fragerman's the largest unknown law firm in the world, what do you see as jurisdictions around the world that actually are treating this more successfully than in Australia in that sort of comparative sense?
It's hard to find them at the moment. Look, even countries like Singapore that have made their success out of importing skilled labour from around the world. It's the same situation in terms of every 6 months there are changes to the rules, slightly tightening the levers to increase minimum salaries and making it that just a little bit more difficult, and it's very much to do with domestic politics. It's very much politic and to deal with that. So in terms of countries, look, it is quite difficult to it is a very sort of common sort of across the board situation at the moment. Having said that, There is a number of initiatives, and government still recognising the value that highly skilled migrants play. And even in Australia, there's been some recent initiatives. For example, the introduction of the Global Talent Scheme, and it's a niche scheme that was introduced last year that is designed to capture highly skilled individuals that fall through the gaps that just don't meet the standard pathways. And it's a special program. It's fast processing. It's really highly valued. So as much as there's a lot of politics, there's a lot of tinkering with policy settings, there are still attempts to ensure that countries remain competitive to attract the global talent. And one thing in at the moment that many countries are struggling with is the global shortage of tech skills. And there's a number of sort of similar programs around the world that are tailored niche programs designed to ensure that the country is the best place as it can to attract that limited talent out there.
Can I also just say that even like this, the Scanlon survey actually shows that about 80% of people actually believe that immigrants are good for the economy. So I'm not really sure what exactly the government's really responding to with a lot of this stuff in terms of the concerns. There's some population concerns and there's infrastructure concerns and things like that. But as long as you put in policies in place to try and deal with that, it should sort itself out. So it's interesting that the population, I think, is a bit further ahead in some respects than the government is on that.
Yeah. And adding to that, 57% of employers that we surveyed are all supportive of bringing in international workers as well. So I agree. I'm not sure where the block's coming from exactly.
Well, what's the proportion of organised labour that would share that view? Probably the trade union. Yeah,
but 18%, right? 18% coverage in terms of live question.
So, look, in addition, there's also the Global Talent Initiative, which is another new scheme that got announced by the department last year, which is basically looking for migrants, so people that want to move here permanently. So, again, sort of really focused on high-value niche skills, and it's going to be 5,000 places that are reserved in this year's migration program.
Hi there. Louise Russell from Estrin Saul Lawyers. I've got a question for you, Gabriella. I noted with interest in your report that you did capture the bridging visa population as part of the skilled, your skilled analysis. I wondered if you've got any more comments around that, because I find that particularly interesting, that was captured at this time and really what that population brings. Part B, my other question was, subclass 400 visas, to my mind, are very much in the skilled space, but I haven't necessarily seen them included or referenced in particular. I wondered if that came within your scope of your analysis, or if it sat outside, why? I think the subclass 400 is topical, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that too.
So a part of the reason why it wasn't included was because the time frame was a bit shorter than what we were considering, but I take that point. We'll probably need to do some more work on it. Now, we've been getting a lot of attention on this piece, so I think temporary migration, this won't be the last time we do temporary migration. The bridging visa one was interesting because we included it as part of the Department of Home Affairs Migration Statistics. They publish temporary stats, so that was part of what guided a lot of our analysis, whether or not we had the information on those groups of people. It's been growing quite a lot over the last couple of years. I know there's been a lot of media attention around that, and I think it partly illustrates some of the administrative burden within the system that we have such a high number of bridging visas. And often they do have work rights, so they take on the work rights of their last held visa. So a lot of them would have work rights, and some of them have unemployment rates of, or that category has unemployment rates of about 20%. So it's quite high, and you can imagine the uncertainty that comes with not knowing whether or not your next visa is going to get approved, and the employer's looking at that going, am I actually going to hire this person, and will they stick around? So there's some argument there to be made for the uncertainty contributing to that level of unemployment.
And I think I've got time for one last question.
Thank you. I'm Jackie Ewer. I'm Vice President of the Migration Institute of Australia, and I have a few comments to make, not too many questions. I'd like to first of all say that really business needs to lobby government, both at a state level and a federal level. At a federal level, they process visas. They've cut and cut and cut the amount of money that they allocate to the Department of Immigration to process those visas, and so you do get long wait times. It would perhaps be appropriate, given the amount of money that they're taking for visas, to allocate a bit more money to the actual process of them. At a local government level, one of the disastrous things for Western Australia was being removed from the regional categorisation in terms of Perth metropolitan area. You have many companies who may have people employed in roles in regional areas, but because the company is based in the metropolitan area, they can't sponsor them under the regional scheme. It's pretty crazy. It affects quite a lot of the mining service companies. So when Perth was removed from that regional scheme, there seemed to be an equation that said we've got so many people unemployed and we've got so many visas. Let's get rid of the visas, and then everybody who's sitting under a kulaba tree will be able to be employed in these highly skilled roles. I think the thinking is changing. You've seen the government introduce a graduate occupation list to try and mitigate the problems that occurred with student visas reducing after that removal from the regional area. But even that graduate occupation list is strange, insofar as it requires the students or the graduates to have 1 year of skilled employment before they can be sponsored under the scheme. Now, what company is going to employ somebody looking to have a long-term employee and hope that after a year or so they'll be able to apply for a long-term visa? And it's really pot luck as to whether they get them or not. The other thing that the graduate occupation list requires is that a company will guarantee a year's employment for somebody that is sponsored under that scheme. And again, why would a company sponsor somebody when they don't really know there's going to be, or why would they guarantee employment for them when they don't know there's going to be a visa? The whole thing contradicts itself. Getting people to sit down and look at the impact of these conditions is hard, and it won't change unless we lobby government.
I'll go back to my LinkedIn example. Dead right. I think the public sector really value those corporate examples of how things don't work, and certainly from our perspective at Fragment, seek to fill those public private knowledge gaps to the best way we can to see positive change. Thank you, Jackie.
So
with that, I think we're out of time, so I'll hand back to Paula. Thank you.